Accession number 18772, real one.
Don Thompson, real one, where were you born, please?
I was born in the county borough of Smethwick, which is on the borders of Birmingham and West Bromwich, at about 9 o'clock on the morning of the 3rd of April, 1927.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Smethwick?
No, we lived in Smethwick until I was 7 years old, and then due to the separation of my parents, we moved into one of the suburbs of Birmingham, a place called Hall Green. That would have been 1934, and I lived there with my mother and my stepfather then until October 1944, when I joined the Young Soldiers Battalion in the Regular Army.
So you spent most of the war years in Hall Green, Birmingham?
I spent all my war years from the 3rd of September 1939 until October 1944, when I left to go into the army. So that means that I was in Birmingham throughout the whole of the war years up to October 1944. So I had first-hand sighting, if you like, of the blitzes which took place in Birmingham and the West Midlands, particularly Coventry. I remember Coventry extremely well, when the German aircraft were circling over Birmingham on their bombing run for about all 6 or 7 hours.
But you didn't visit Coventry?
I didn't visit Coventry, no, until about 1950-ish, when even then the terrible amount of bomb damage was still in evidence, but 6 or 7 years after the war had finished. But Birmingham suffered extremely heavily in the blitzes, particularly in November 1941, when the city centre of Birmingham, the Ballroom, New Street, Corporation Street, was heavily ravaged by German bombings, and the actual air attack went on for about 13 hours. As I recall, the sirens sounded about 20 past 6 in the evening, and the all clear didn't go till nearly 7:30 the next morning. And all one could see from our back garden, from the outside of the Anderson Shelter, was this huge, thick, black pall of smoke rising above the rooftops. And it was obvious, you know, that the city had suffered a severe attack. And that would have been, I think, about the 7th of November 1941. But it really was a night that I shall never, ever forget, because sleep was impossible with the aircraft going overhead and the anti-aircraft fire. It was quite a night.
Was it 41 or 40?
Oh, 1941.
You sure?
I'm positive, yes, yes. I remember it well. November 1941. It seemed as though the south and southeast of England took most of the battering during the 1940s. But in 1941, the Luftwaffe seemed to extend its bombing campaign outside of London.
Any other details you can give about the bombing of Birmingham that you experienced personally yourself?
Following the extremely heavy air raid in November 1941, my mother, who was working in a munition factory in Birmingham, came home about 9:30 that morning, having walked most of the way home because of the transport situation due to the heavy air raid, and heard that my grandmother's house in Smethwick might have been affected by the bombing. So mother wanted to go to Smethwick to find out whether her mother was still all right. Usually it would take us about, 1.5 hours on 3 buses to get from Hall Green to Smethwick. But on this occasion, we left home at about 11:15, and we got to Smethwick at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because the buses obviously were not running to schedule, as one can imagine. And I remember getting off the bus at the King's Head at Bearwood, And again, looking back towards the city centre and seeing this dreadful black pall of smoke, which was sort of on the horizon there. And it was obvious that the fires that had been started during the night were still burning quite fiercely. However, the long and short of it was that when we finally got to within 300 or 400 yards of my grandmother's house in Smethwick, it was cordoned off because there was what is believed to be an exploded bomb was tangled up in the tramways outside Smethwick Council House. And the story behind that was, during the height of the Blitz, an air raid warden was walking back towards the council house in Smethwick to report into his command post, which was in the cellars of the council house. And as he walked into the square outside the council house, he saw what he thought was a parachute and a body swinging beneath it from the tram wires. And he immediately ran back up the road down which he'd come to the nearest telephone, rang into his controller and said, "There's a paratrooper caught in the tram wires in High Street." So the controller said, "Oh, yes, and where might that be?" So the air raid warden said, "Outside the council house." And of course, there were panic stations there, and the Home Guard turned out, surrounded the area. And what it turned out to be was one of the German Air Force's latest innovations, which was a landmine which they were dropping by parachute. And unfortunately, this landmine had tangled up in the tramways, and the base of the bomb was swinging about 2 feet from the ground. Subsequently, of course, the whole area was cordoned off. The whole population was evacuated until the Royal Naval bomb disposal team came and got rid of the thing. But it was quite funny, and the air raid warden took a delight in going around all the local pubs, you know, for weeks after, saying how he thought he'd seen a German parachutist tangle up in the tramways outside the council house. But the blitzes were difficult, and they gradually tailed off until about mid 1942. But the significant thing that perhaps sticks out in my mind as a youngster was the night of the Coventry air raid. Mother was working nights at the munitions factory, and my stepfather, who was an official working with Birmingham City Corporation, was a storekeeper at the local corporation depot. And when the siren sounded, stepfather needed to go on duty in order to be on hand for perhaps emergency repairs, stand, ballast, what have you. And subsequently, I was on my own in the air raid shelter for the whole of that raid. And I was absolutely fascinated, if that is the correct word, was standing outside the shelter watching, literally watching the German aircraft circle above the city with their navigation lights on, if you please, so that they wouldn't collide with each other before they started their bombing run onto this, what at the time, of course, was an undisclosed target. It wasn't until later the next day, of course, that it became generally known that it was Coventry that had been attacked. But the attack must have gone on for about 10, 11, 12 hours. And the alarming thing was that there didn't seem to be much opposition from the from our own anti-aircraft batteries and night fighters. They just weren't anywhere to be seen or heard. Apart from that, then of course the blitzes on Birmingham petered out, and the country sort of settled down into what an almost passive state of war in 43 and 44. And then, of course, the battles in North Africa came along. Personal interest here, because my father, by that time, was with the First Army. Later, he went into Italy, having come through Dunkirk, of course, in 1940, because Dad had been a Territorial Army soldier in the Royal Engineers from about 1936. So, of course, in 1939, he was one of the first batch. He was among the first batch of TA and reservists to be called to the colours. He went out to France, I think, in about late September 1939, and came back through Dunkirk.
What was your address in Hall Green?
Our address was 23 Blythsford, that's Blythsford, Blythsford Road.
And did any bombs fall there?
The nearest we had was a bomb that dropped about 150 yards away in a road called Skelcher Road, which was just off Blythsford Road, towards the bottom end. That demolished two houses. And then in a further air raid, an unexploded bomb went through the roof of a house not far away in Baldwin's Lane. And again, the area was cordoned off for about 3 or 4 days until bomb disposal could get around and deal with it. Of course, the bomb disposal units, both from the Royal Navy and the Army, were so busy that any unexploded bombs that weren't, as you were, causing any undue restrictions on life were left until the opportunity arose. But they eventually blew up the one in Baldwin's Lane, and again, two more houses were demolished by the blast. I joined the Army Cadet Force at the age of 15, and some young people from the youth organisations, the Air Training Corps, the Royal Naval Cadets and the Army Cadet Force were invited to offer their services to the civil defence authorities, and this we did by acting as messengers in between the ARP posts in the event of breakdown in telephone communications. I was based at the council house at Spark Hill. They had a cellar there converted into an air raid post, and we would report there when the sirens were due to go, and await our instructions as to what we needed to do.
Did you do very much?
Not a great deal. 42, 43 and 44 was comparatively quiet. What we did do mainly, even though there were not air raids, we would go around the various posts to which we were allocated, picking up situation reports and bringing them back to the controller, who was in the basement of the council house. We didn't get involved in any air raids after that, simply because the air raids by that time had ceased.
Was Hall Green heavily bombed?
Hall Green was not heavily bombed. The adjoining suburb of Shirley and Solihull, which of course was in the county of Warwickshire, they had shadow factories there where they were building aircraft and armoured fighting vehicles. So several bombing raids were made to try to locate the factories, but because the Germans obviously didn't know where they were, they were always way off target. So in many instances, bombs fell into open countryside, which surrounded the two shadow factories, which then became Austin and Rover and Land Rovers, as they are now. Most of the German attacks towards 42, 43 were concentrated on the Castle Bromwich area, again, where there was a huge shadow factory, which I think were making Spitfires and later Lancaster bombers. I think the Germans had a vague idea where the factory was, because that particular part of Birmingham was bombed quite heavily. I can't recall the civilian casualties, but many of the air raids did take place over that part. But the blitzes in November and December 1941, I think, with hindsight, were initiated to terrify the civilian population. I don't think there was any sort of military objective, because when you consider the total damage that was effected on Digbeth, Derrytown, the Bullring, Corporation Street, New Street, you know, the city centre was almost completely destroyed, with no military targets to be attacked. It was only after 1941 that the Luftwaffe seemed to settle down in picking out its targets and having a go at those.
What do you think the public morale was like in the Blitz?
Actually, it was quite strong. The ARP wardens used to visit every house in Blythsford Road and all the other surrounding roads, of course, on a regular basis, making certain that people were all right. sort of bringing people together. We used to go into each other's homes for a chat, you know, and perhaps a cup of tea, bearing in mind the rationing and a chat. We were always very conscious of the location of families within the houses. For example, we were always advised not to sleep in the bedrooms, but to bring beds downstairs into the safest possible place, so that if the house was damaged or destroyed, then at least you wouldn't come tumbling through the floors in your bed from upstairs. So mother and stepfather brought their double bed down into the front room, and I had a single bed in the back room, and that is how we spent most of the war, until it was obvious, you know, that the Blitzes were a thing of the past. But we were all aware of where other families would have been at any time if the house had been damaged. And when we went out, we always made a point of letting neighbours know, so that if the house was damaged, then the civil defence people wouldn't waste time looking for a house which they knew was empty. Very interesting, but I think in general the people, in actual fact, as neighbours, we became closer to each other rather than apart, because we were sharing a common thing, if you like, you know, this question of survival. It's quite extraordinary.
What was your own attitude towards the German enemy?
In the beginning, of course, it was a nonentity, because as a 12-year-old, I didn't fully understand what was going on. It was only when Dunkirk came about, when I realised, you know, that perhaps my father was involved in it, and the newsreel pictures in the cinema began to show Dunkirk as it was, that we began to realise, you know, that this thing was serious. Because when the war first started, everybody was of the opinion, you know, that, oh, it'll all be over by Christmas. You know, this sort of attitude, oh, it won't last. I remember being at my grandmother's house one night and being bathed in the sink because we had no bathroom there, and the insurance man came in and said, no need to worry, he said, it'll all be over by Christmas. So I remember my grandmother said, they said that about yeah, in 1914, and look how long that lasted. Oh, it won't last that long. It'll all be over by Christmas, because it wasn't. As you know, there's the false war between 1939 and May 1940, and then of course the balloon went up literally.
Did you listen to Churchill broadcast?
I remember Neville Chamberlain's broadcast on the morning of the 3rd of September. It was a bright sunny morning, and we had sort of a patio window that opened out onto the backyard, and I was sitting there in a deck chair having a glass of pop, and the old Philco radio that we had was just inside the doorway, and I remember mother coming in and switching it on and heard Neville Chamberlain, you know, with his famous words, so subsequently this country is now a state of war with Nazi Germany. Yes, I listened to Churchill, because by then, you see, the schools were beginning to take an interest and felt, you know, that we had a right to know what was going on. So subsequently, perhaps half an hour each morning would be taken by our particular teacher to sort of bring us up to date on what was happening. So by the time I left school in 1941, you see, I had a fair idea of what was happening. I did actually pass my 11 plus, but because the grammar school, which I should have gone to, had been closed down as a school early in 1940, was built into a sort of a rest centre for displaced people. There was Mosley Grammar School, which is about a couple of miles away. It was a huge school, and it was absolutely ideal, you know, for a rest centre for taking in people who were bombed out, etc. So, of course, I wasn't able to fulfil my dream of going to the grammar school. So I left school in 1941, went into the plumbing trade, joined the Army Cadet Force 1915, enlisted in the regular army at just turned 17, and then I went to join the Young Soldiers Battalion at Blackdown in early October 1944.
In Surrey?
Yes, Blackdown, yes, in Surrey, yeah, just outside Frimley.
And can you tell me about the basic training that you had?
Basic training, in the first instance, mindful of the fact that most of us in our particular company were either ex-naval cadets or ex-army cadets. We had a certain amount of discipline, which of course was appreciated by the instructors, because they didn't have to start right from scratch. The whole idea of Young Soldiers Battalion was to instill in you a sense of discipline, a sense of purpose, and the need to understand the objectives of military training. That was to basically to kill or be killed. That was the essence, and in all weapon training sessions, that was hammered into us, you know, from morning to night. Discipline, self-control, barrack room inspections, they were a nightmare. Oh, my goodness me. We'd get up at 5 o'clock on a Saturday morning, you know, ready for barrack room inspection at 10 o'clock, and everything had to be highly polished, neatly folded. If it wasn't, you know, the horrible lance corporal, he'd come along, you know, and whip your bell up and say, right, now start again, you know. And then at 10 o'clock, the platoon commander would come round, you know, and he'd go through the barrack room with a fine-tooth comb, make certain that all your shirts were folded properly, that your pillows were creased and your mess tins were polished and the studs on the bottom of your boots were polished. And, oh, goodness me. The tragic thing was, of course, that if anything was found to be wrong, then there was a repeat barrack room inspection at 2 o'clock, which meant you couldn't go out on Saturday afternoon. So if it was your bed or your kit that was at fault, you know, then you had a rough time for the rest of the morning. Domestic science played a very large part. Corporal Andrews, I think, was the name, taught us how to sew on buttons, how to darn our socks, how to iron our shirts, how to be self-sufficient. The Army Catering Corps taught us basic cooking in mess tins, you know, how to cook rice and potatoes in the mess tins over a wood fire. Weapon training, personal hygiene, every single aspect was taken into consideration to ensure that at the end of the 6 months that you were fit to be transferred into regular army.
What was the name of this Young Soldiers Battalion you were in?
The 29th Training Battalion, Blackdown. It was a training battalion for regular army. But he had the Young Soldiers Training Wing. We went in at 17 and a half. The first 6 weeks were what were called primary training. We wore the standard Royal Coat of Arms cap badge. And at the end of 6 weeks, there was a pruning out process. Those who didn't come up to the required standard were then transferred out to the regiments or corps for which they had stated a preference prior to joining. Those of us who passed out the first 6 weeks, then we started then to get down to regular army training. Primary training was a question of drill, weapon training, foot drill, arms drill, and the basics which every recruit in the army went through at that particular stage. Physical fitness, of course, played a tremendous part in our lives, particularly after the first 6 weeks, you know, when it was realised that we'd gone through primary training, now the real stuff began. And physical fitness played a prime part. We had at least an hour's physical training every day, swimming two or three times a week in the swimming baths at Aldershot, incidentally with no swimming trunks. It was a question, you know, in the nude and in you go sort of thing. Looking back upon it, it was an extremely rewarding time in my life, despite the fact that I would suspect, as young soldiers, we didn't exactly appreciate what the end result would be. You know, that we would be turned out into super fit, super efficient killing machines, as they would put it in broadest sense. But as young soldiers, I think we were very much aware towards the end of what the thing was all about. Our biggest concern in the NAFI at night was, you know, sort of, well, I hope the war doesn't end before we get into it sort of thing. A completely, utterly ridiculous point of view. But bearing in mind, you know, that we were absolutely super fit and super trained, you know, we felt that time was running out and that, you know, the Germans were being defeated too fast for us. I know it was so silly, but bearing in mind that we were barely 18 years old, the glamour of war, of course, you know, was still uppermost in our minds. The horrid little bits, of course, hadn't come across us at that time. And I don't think anyone actually was willing to pretend what it was really, really like, you know, to be caught up in a battle situation. Soon found out in Korea, of course, but there you are, that's another story.
What did you get out of all this?
Discipline, self-respect, and an awareness, you know, that properly trained, the human body can virtually respond to anything that it is asked to do. The first time we went over the assault course, for example, you know, we were absolutely shattered at the end of it. We thought, oh, gosh, you know. But after about 4 or 5 months, we were just sailing over the thing. We were so fit and healthy and so well trained, you know, that it was, you know, and we were all the same age and we were all fired with the same objective, you know, to successfully complete our transfer into regular army. That was the only objective that we had. Sergeant McLaughlin was our platoon sergeant. I always remember dear old Mac. He was almost a father figure to us, you know, and he'd come in the barrack room of the morning and he'd walk around, you know, and he'd look at us and he wouldn't say anything, but you could sort of read the expression on his face, you know, as he went to the end of the barrack room and walked out the door, and he looked back and was to say, you know, I'm proud of you lads. And it really got through to us, you know, that he was someone who respected us for who we were and how we had responded to his teachings. And it was quite a gratifying thought, really, you know, to think possibly that we'd done something right. Because I must say, as young soldiers, the question of dissent or quarrelling or even questioning, you know, what was right and what was wrong was you know, just didn't enter our minds. We were there as young soldiers, you know, and that was it. You know, we had the traditions of the British Army, you know, our own particular regiments.
Would people go to him with problems?
They had to be severe problems because obviously there was the chain of control. We had a young lance corporal and a corporal who slept in the barrack room who were directly responsible for us. And then there was a platoon corporal and platoon sergeant who sort of had their own quarters. So initially, if you had a problem, then of course you went to the lance corporal first and he referred you to the corporal. And then they went up the chain of command, possibly to the platoon commander. But yes, there was always someone there to listen to you. But as young soldiers, you were expected to sort out your own problems if you could. Because, you know, self-reliance. As Mac always used to say, you know, when you're out there, don't expect myself or Corporal Martin, you know, or Corporal Stevens always to be there to sort of guide you on your way. You had to think for yourself, and this, of course, again was the whole objective. One very interesting thing: at 20 weeks, we underwent personnel selection, and one by one, we went in to see the personnel selection officer, with the captain in the King John Yorkshire. Anyway, that's relevant. Anyway, went in and saluted and sat down. Right.